Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Schriever Space Power Series. I'm Kevin Chilton, Explorer Chair at the Mitchell Institute's Space Power Advantage Center of Excellence. And today, it's my pleasure to host Major General Gregory Gagnon, the Deputy Chief of Space Operations for Intelligence, to talk about the Space Force's intelligence efforts, which are foundational for acquisitions, operations, policy, and strategic direction. The bottom line, what our potential adversaries are doing and planning is critical. We need to understand those actions and respond to ensure we maintain our warfighting advantage on orbit and beyond. As you can see in the news headlines, our competitors and potential adversaries are rapidly fielding a wide array of space capabilities that threaten our national security interests. Just a few weeks ago, we were thrilled to have General Gagnon join us at Mitchell Institute's 2024 Space Power Security Forum. He was awesome, and if you missed it, a little plug here, you can find his remarks plus all the other panel speakers, including General Saltzman and Dr. Plum, on our website. With that, General Gagnon, welcome to the Mitchell Institute. It's great to have you here. Always good to see you and be with you. And before we get into the Q&A section, I'd like to offer you an opportunity to offer some of your thoughts.
Well, thank you for having me over here this morning. It's easy to support things in the DC sort of metro area and help spread the word about why it is absolutely critical that our warfighting military service focus on delivering and gaining space superiority, not only for our joint partners, but for the whole coalition. One underlying principle for us is that we seek to reinforce international norms that have helped our boat rise in America, but many boats around the world. And it's important to understand that space is part of that deterrent force for America and for freedom-loving countries around the world. We must gain and maintain space superiority in order to unlock the precision, the mobility, and the lethality of the Joint and Coalition Force. So I'm excited to be here. You know, we're 4.5 years old. And what I'm really excited about is I usually talk about the threat and people say, hey, that was such a scary brief. And what I want to make sure I cover today is not just how fast the threat is going, but how fast the Space Force is moving to match and outmatch that threat.
Terrific. That's great. Well, I know personnel has got to be one of the main yes. focus areas that you have working on the Space Force staff. Folks are often confused about what a staff does in the Pentagon, the service staffs. It's quite simply organized, train, and equip as your major focus area. And my first question has to do with an old observation I had. It's almost 2 decades old now. When I was at Air Force Space Command, I remember visiting my A2 intel shop at the time. And I was a bit surprised to find out that none of the uniformed officers in my intelligence shop had ever been assigned to a space unit before, and that their follow-on was not going to be to a space unit. So in those days, the Air Force intelligence community policy was, in general, that one tour at Air Force Space Command was enough. You checked that square and moved on. And nor did I find their education in the realm of space particularly solid. I think, you know, and to be fair, in 2006 and 2007, although we could see rumblings on the horizon, space was still considered by our policymakers as a peaceful domain. So there was no push to change that. Now that it's a warfighting domain, what is your focus on training the intel officers of the future that I was so blessed to have when I was a young fighter pilot for the Space Force going forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I will tell you that that is a major focus of what I do as the career field manager for intelligence officers and enlisted inside the force. For the larger audience, let me just go big to small. The Space Force is 0.5% of the uniformed military in the Department of Defense. We're the smallest service. But because we're the smallest service, we have to fight above our weight. In the other services, I grew up sort of in the same combat Air Force you grew up in, right? My first assignment was Kunsan Air Base with F-16s with General Lauterbach when we were lieutenants. But in those 30 years since then, right, the world has changed. We've established a Space Force. We have to fight for space superiority. So we have to build new training, new education to build new humans who can win in that domain. Mm-hmm. And we've moved out on that in the last 2 years within the Space Force. In the Space Force, in the uniform part of the Space Force, 14% of the force is intelligence professionals.
Okay. How does that compare to other services, would you say?
The Air Force is 6%.
Okay.
The Army, 6.3%. Okay. So you have a higher proportion of uniform people who do intelligence in the Space Force. But let me add a few other statistics that are important. In the Space Force, the person to SCI facility ratio is like 1 to 40, because the material we're dealing with, you know, is highly classified often, right? In the Army, that's like 1 to 1,500 soldiers.
Okay.
So there is a whole different dynamic that takes place with what information you use to understand the adversary and how you build the basic blocking and tackling skills inside your intelligence service. In the intelligence service, similar to the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, our officer corps is more generalized, and our enlisted corps is hyper-specialized. And in our enlisted corps of the Guardian Intelligence Formation, we have some of the smartest enlisted force you could ever meet, both technically brilliant as well as socially aware on geopolitical stance. So that is really our strength. Our strength in Guardian Intelligence is our enlisted corps. And the enlisted to officer ratio inside Guardian Intelligence is about 1 to 4, 1 to 4.5, which is exactly what it was in the Air Force.
Okay. So now there's a career path for a second lieutenant intelligence officer who's in the Space Force to actually spend their career in the Space Force in space intelligence.
Yeah, we are about to adjust that a little bit.
Okay.
And adjusting that a little bit is one of General Saltzman's primary objectives, which is called Officer Training Course, OTC. In the Marine Corps, when you raise your right hand and you become a second lieutenant, you go to an officer basic course. And for the rest of your time in the Marine Corps, every Marine's a rifleman.
Right.
So in the Space Force, starting in this fall, we're prototyping this new course where every officer who commissions as a second lieutenant will go through a one-year course with 4 months of space operations, 4 months of intelligence operations, and 4 months of cyberspace operations. They will then go to an operational unit that executes cyberspace operations, intelligence operations, or space operations. As they approach the end of their first tour, they are then going to be offered the opportunity to further specialize in any of those elements or cross over into those elements.
Great.
They will also be offered the opportunity to become what's called an acquisition officer or engineer. Mm-hmm. And in the Air Force, this program existed. It was called OPEX. It's when you could allow an acquirer to do an operational tour before mm-hmm. they specialized in acquisition. And what this will buy us is an officer corps that fundamentally understands from their first assignment that the purpose of the service is to gain and maintain space superiority. The second purpose of the service is to use that advantage from space to inform and fuel the joint force to be successful as part of the joint force.
That's great. You know, as you were talking, it reminded me when I was a lieutenant in a fighter squadron, we had an intelligence officer assigned to mm-hmm. the squadron who lived in the squadron. And they were typically junior, maybe first lieutenants. And so they got to live with the operators mm-hmm. and also provided a great service to us as I did analysis and kept track of the threat in Korea at the time where I was working. And so you reflect back on that as well. You were one of them, right? When you were at Kunsan. Yeah. So is that the model? Is that model going to be, I think I heard you just say that's going to be the model going forward. You'll have intel officers, junior intel officers embedded at the squadron level.
Yeah, we already do. So Perfect. We already Perfect. Have intel embedded at every operational squadron in the Space Force.
Right.
And we also have the ability to train them on current processes in TTP inside our institutional intelligence forces that gain and maintain an information advantage.
Now, we've read recently where the 75th Intelligence Surveillance and Reconnaissance yep. Squadron has stood up. Mm-hmm. Can you tell our audience a little bit yep. about the purpose of this organization?
Yeah. So there were some missing pieces in the formation of what was previously the Air Force kind of Space Command. And missing pieces, I'm talking about being able to run an intelligence cycle to enable all of the joint functions. And of course, the joint functions like information, intelligence, maneuver, right? Protection, fires, command and control, those things that every joint formation must do, right? There were missing elements inside our cupboard, basically, or our toolbox. Those missing functions were a specialized targeting squadron, a specialized exploitation squadron that exploited sensors in real time to inform decisions for, say, a commander who has to decide whether to move satellites or not move satellites, right? Because someone has to take collected sensor data, turn it into information, and then turn it into intelligence. As much as the business sector talks about AI and things like that, you have to leverage that. But that is still a highly trained human endeavor to understand what raw collected intelligence actually means to maneuver and fires in mission planning. Mm-hmm. So those elements were missing. So the 25th stood up in August. So about, I think about a year ago.
Okay.
And then there was a squadron that established about 90 days later, which was at Wright Pat, a different location, which is the real-time processing and exploitation squadron. In the Air Force, that targeting squadron has a counterpart. It's the 363rd targeting wing that's headquartered at Langley. That PED squadron that's at Wright Pat has a companion in the Air Force. And I'm sorry for using Air Force analogies, but I'm a little bit of a prisoner of my own experience mm-hmm. as well. That PED squadron, if you will, right, that operational intel producing organization is that DCGS construct, which is the 480th wing in the Air Force.
Right.
We have a little bit of a scale issue, right? The Space Force is small. So if you see something that is a group or a wing, in the Air Force, it's generally a squadron size formation in the Space Force.
Great. And can you explain to our audience what PED means?
Yeah, PED is, and I grew up kind of doing this. When the U-2 would fly in, say, over Bosnia, I would be a first lieutenant at the time sitting in California. Inside my 100-person crew, we controlled the nose on the U-2. It would turn because we were mm-hmm. turning a scroll ball in California. We would control those SIGINT sensors on both of the wings, right? And we would tune those to collect the information we needed. That information would come in because this is 95 timeframe, 30 years ago. This was the beginning of the digital world, right? It would come in as ones and zeros. We would take those ones and zeros and we would look at it and we would say, oh, that formed an image. We would have someone specially trained to look at a radar image and say, that radar image says that there's six tanks here or there's six trucks here. Those ELINT specialists would look at those electronic signals and say, hey, that's that type of radar. And we would put that information out. That's processing. That's exploitation. And then when you deliver it back to people who need that information, that's dissemination.
Okay.
That's PED.
Okay.
That was a missing piece for operational space warfighting.
Now, I had the opportunity to serve at Beale. Very proud of the men and women forward, you know, putting the platform up, and then very proud too of the intelligence squadrons that were mm-hmm. resident there. They were doing exactly what you said. And there's a lot of similarity there between that and space, because yes. here you are controlling a sensor on a platform on the other side of the world, using a space communication link to do it.
Yep.
And so are we taking any lessons learned from that into the Space Force from how the U-2 has been operated over the years and the power it's brought to the warfight?
I will tell you the lessons I took out of that weren't just as being the officer on that 100-person crew was called a mission commander, mm-hmm. and that was like my first job. But I did that at Osan for the yep. U-2s that flew in Osan. I did that in Hawaii for the UAVs that flew in CENTCOM. I did that at the National Security Agency for the SIGINT elements that executed parts of that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The lessons I took from that were lessons that were brought home to me later when I was at Air Combat Command as the A2, mm-hmm. as the investment banker who pays for everything,
right?
So what you have to do is you have to make sure all the systems work together from the beginning. So I have a little bit of a blank sheet of paper. So with that blank sheet of paper, I can make sure that proprietary options are down selected, that open architectures are prioritized, that I actually have a data management plan that's already in execution, talking about how a sensor collects data, stores data, and then is used for making decisions, whether those decisions are general chefs, right? Command and control decisions as mm-hmm. the three-star commander of operational space, or whether those are decisions of an O3 who works in an orbital warfare squadron about what they have to do with their specific spacecraft. Right? Those elements are in play. Those elements are in play, not just with government sensors today. So let me give you an example of where we've gone very rapidly. Not so long ago when the Space Force stood up, we were executing control and operations of about 2 to 3 dozen government-related sensors in all phenomenologies, electro-optical, right? The ability to look up at space and say, hey, that's a satellite. I can see the glint, right? Or using a radar to look up there and build that observation. So 2 to 3 dozen sensors around the world, predominantly out of the old missile warning world, right? Old stuff older than me, right? To today, we are now orchestrating the collection on about 1,000 priority targets in space, right? 1,000 out of 9,500 satellites in space. Those are the priorities. With 600 apertures around the world in 5 different phenomenologies. And not only are we collecting this information, we're orchestrating this with the commercial sector so that we bring it all into a data repository that's open, that allows not just ourselves, but our partners to have access to it, and our partners being U.S. government partners, our partners being coalition partners. We have over 22 partners using data out of this infrastructure. And this is the infrastructure that Space Systems Command out in Los Angeles put together called the Unified Data Library.
Right.
And I know here in D.C., this is my first Pentagon assignment, so that usually shocks people. But here in D.C., the thing that turns into the clickbait for the news is always programs behind. This is not a program behind. This is a program rapidly ahead.
That's right.
We are moving at phenomenal speed. And it's a testament to some of the key people at SSC.
That's great. Out in California.
Yes, sir.
At Space Systems Command. That's great. You know, people talk a lot about AI today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, AI doesn't work if you don't have a good data lake to draw from.
That's correct.
With accurate data. And so that's great. So the UDL is kind of the data lake.
It is.
For space. That's great. You know, when you were at U.S. Space Command, I know one of General Dickinson's top priorities was to increase space situational awareness.
Yep.
How's that going?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me use the same 5-year time frame.
Okay,
so I just kind of walked through a 5-year time frame where I talked about 24 to 36 things around the planet to 600 things around the planet. Okay, when you have access around the planet with your apertures, right, you get overlapping coverage. That's a benefit. You also eliminate gaps. You also increase revisit rates. And all of those, if I told you what those numbers were in Moscow and Beijing, those pencils would be writing rapidly, right? Because they want to know that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But let me give you a metric I can share, okay? Space Force stands up. We're pushing out from the Joint Commercial Office, the JCO, right? We're pushing out from there maneuver alerts about 6 to 7 a month. Hey, we saw something that maneuvered. Today, we're putting out, 11,000 a month. A month. So.
And this is just our potential adversaries, or is this everybody?
This is everybody.
Okay.
This is actually, I'll be more specific. This is the 1,000 objects that I'm interested in.
Okay.
Okay.
So
sometimes I want to be looking at my own object to see if anything's going on around it, right? So these are my, if you would use joint terms, I would say my named areas of interest, right? And their objects. Of that 11,000, that's hard for people to kind of understand. So the equivalent to that is, General Shelton, we're in Colorado Springs. You're excited that the Space Force is standing up, and you come to Greg, and Greg says, I'm going to give you an investment in the Space Force. And you say, oh, Greg, I don't know about that, but you know, we're at Red Leg Brewery, and you buy in, right? And you say, I'm going to give you $1,000, Greg. And I say, okay, I'll take your $1,000. Today, as I'm talking to you, I'm giving you back $1.8 million.
In benefit.
Yeah, that's the build of that rate. Those 6 or 7 maneuver alerts to 11,000 a month.
Right.
That's the scale. That's profound. That's a great advancement because of our partnership with the commercial sector, our ability to manage the data in a reasonable way into a unified data library. Then what I would tell you is those alerts are being generated by Guardians and by 11 other countries. And we've created the opportunity here for other people in other countries to help. And we're training about 6 people a month to learn how to do this first level analysis for analysis. Mm-hmm. We have 100 people trained now. We'll have 175 in 12 months. They exist on 3 continents. And because they exist on 3 continents, we're gaining 24/7 coverage, exploitation coverage.
Right, right. I love it. I think a lot of people think Space Force is just concerned about everything above 100 kilometers. I like to remind folks that terrestrial, terrain on the planet matters to the Space Force. And you describe it so well. It matters that you have friends and allies around the world that will allow you to either position our sensors on their terrain, their territory,
yep.
or share what they collect. And it sounds like that's moving forward very well.
It's moving forward. It's moving forward with our traditional allies that we're used to, and as well as new allies. Mm-hmm. And don't think this is a non-competitive market. The PLA and the CCP are trying to do the same thing. They are approaching countries in South America. They are approaching countries in Africa. And they're saying, hey, we have these great space observation centers that are academic, and we want you to open them up. But what they're really trying to do is solve their coverage gaps in space. Now, the benefit here for the U.S. side is we're bringing together those countries that believe in the rule of law. Mm-hmm. We're bringing together those countries that have the same values and ideas that we have. And we're giving them a say in the execution of the operation and then giving them access to even greater data sets. And all of that is a benefit for reinforcing that we are prepared in space to see what malign actors might be doing, so that we can attribute that activity. Mm-hmm. And then through all elements of power, diplomatic, informational, military, economic, hold them accountable for things that they do that we consider outside of norms or illegal.
Which is integrated deterrence.
It is, sir.
Which is, a topic du jour of late. But deterrence requires attribution capability.
It does.
So this is the way you do it, clearly. Yeah.
General Saltzman kind of discusses this in his theory of competitive endurance. Mm-hmm. And he talks about this as avoiding operational surprise.
Yeah.
So inside our Space Force FY25 budget, 8% of our resources are applied against avoiding operational surprise. This is the fruits of some of that 8%. The second part of this is, and I know it made a lot of news last month when we put our commercial strategy out there. Mm-hmm. This is the example of stronger together. This is the example of buy what you can, only develop what you must. And this has been quite a success. Now, not to oversell it, this is about broad area search and situational awareness. When you need to do activities to apply force, you generally need greater sensitivity of intelligence, greater precision, greater movement detection. We keep that on the inside of the military force so that we can still maintain and be prepared to do responsible counterspace campaign.
Mm. Very good. Well, you've talked about a lot of things that have rapidly developed to make our Space Force better prepared to do the deterrence mission and certainly to fight and win if required. Is there any intelligence coming back that you've seen that shows that the Chinese are paying attention to this and it's having an impact on them either to accelerate their programs or maybe to step back a little bit?
I would say that the Chinese are watching this very closely. And I say that from a position of probably, I would say, knowing. I know they are watching it closely. Yeah. I know that in their operational design, they seek to gain space superiority. It's clear to me that both Beijing and Moscow view space as a warfighting domain. They have said as much. Mm-hmm. I just read what they say, whether it's President Putin or President Xi, whether it's their Central Military Commission or their War College. I pay attention to that. But not only are they saying that space is a warfighting domain, they're building military forces for that fight. Mm-hmm. The PLA has rapidly advanced in space in a way that few people can really appreciate. I try to think about historical analogies about rapid buildups. I haven't seen a rapid buildup like this in my mind. I was thinking about World War II, and you and I have the same history class, right? Because right. We're military officers. But even as I was looking more broadly, an adversary arming this fast is profoundly concerning.
Particularly in peacetime.
Yes,
right.
Yes, sir.
I mean,
yes, sir.
World War II, we didn't start building up. We built up pretty quickly, but it was after the first shot was fired.
Admiral Richards, who was the prior STRATCOM commander, labeled the moniker breakout pace for nuclear forces, right? He talked about the fact that, you know, we thought they'd have 500 warheads, but they're rapidly getting to 1,000, right? The breakout pace in space is profound. Since December 31st, 2015, when they established the Military Aerospace Force, okay, that's their space force, right? There has been a 550% increase on on-orbit capability. I have been personally involved in tracking that since that time. I would tell you that it's not just when I started telling that story, it was, oh my Lord, look how they can attack all our key assets in space. And that was my lead scary story, if you will. They have these direct ascent missiles that can launch from Western China and go up and destroy satellites. And guess what? They're going to build a lot of them, right? Mm-hmm. They can use these lasers and laze things that are in space and cause these satellites not to work. That was sort of my main narrative. My main narrative today is way more concerning. My main narrative today is of that rapid growth in things in space. For the last 2 years, they've placed over 200 satellites in space both years. Of that, over half of them are remote sensing satellites. Okay, remote sensing satellites that are purpose-built to surveil and do reconnaissance in the Western Pacific and globally. Mm-hmm. Satellites that are designed with a proliferated architecture with many numbers so that they are resilient against attack. An architecture that isn't designed for efficiency and cost effective. An architecture that's designed to go to war and sustain in war. And the purpose of reconnaissance and surveillance from the ultimate high ground is, of course, to inform decisions about fire control for militaries, right?
Right.
It's to provide indications and warning of sailors, Marines, airmen trying to move west, if directed, to defend freedom, right? They will now, in a way that we're not comfortable talking about in America, they will be inside a rapidly expanding weapons engagement zone.
Right.
So for our non-military folks who are listening, a weapons engagement zone means that they can track their target and put weapons on that target, even against mobile targets. Few countries had that advantage. In my lifetime in a uniform, it's been us. Our allies have had it because they've partnered with us. But it's really just been us against mobile targets at extremely long distances. That monopoly is over.
I'm glad there's two sides of the coin here.
Yeah.
You brought up both of those, you know. So I'd like to pull the thread on the latter. What are we doing to, in the event of a conflict in the Western Pacific, to blind those assets or to make them not be able to do their job of tracking our carrier fleets, our aircraft, our logistics fleets that will be required to transit the Pacific region? How do we take their massive, numerous on-orbit intelligence collection capabilities away from them?
Yeah. So when I talk to the formation, I say, hey, if we were designed just to deliver combat support into the joint force, we're part of the joint force, right? If we were designed just to deliver combat support, we'd be a combat support agency. We're not. We're an armed service. We're a military service. Mm-hmm. Our job is first to gain and maintain space superiority, which means being able to hold at risk how other nations use space so that their use of space, which can be used in a hostile manner, right, to empower fire control elements, right? It needs to be denied, degraded, right, in time of war. Otherwise, we're breaking our solemn promise to our warfighting brothers and sisters who are on ships, who are in airfields in the Western Pacific, and we're breaking our promise to our coalition partners, right?
That's great, because that is a huge change in policy from 15 years ago. And standing up the Space Force was part of that, recognizing it as a service that has a mission in the joint fight to not only continue to enable, right? I mean, those are critical capabilities the Space Force provides, with whether it be GPS or over-the-horizon communications, global communications, we could go on and on, missile warning, but also to be able to deny those kinds of capabilities to an adversary that would use them against our other military forces. That's terrific.
So going back to your beginning thing, we talked about that targeting squadron. That targeting squadron is purposely designed to do target systems analysis, which will allow for identifying what centers of gravity. I'm using some nerdy intel terms, but basically find vulnerabilities in systems of systems.
Right.
So that from a multi-domain perspective, right, using all elements of military power, right, whether, you know, that could be taking out a link between a satellite and a ground. That could be hitting a key node of that on the ground from a multi-domain perspective, identifying that critical node, identifying that critical vulnerability, and making the Joint Force Commander aware of those options. In the past, that level of analysis against highly technical systems was hard to develop in people who touched into an assignment and touched out.
Right.
But now that we have an Space Force purpose-built to think about that, we're purposely doing that.
That's great. Well, so the other side of the coin, the enabling side, means you've got to protect the assets that you have up there. And you have multiple threat vectors that I think go beyond what most other combat agencies have to face or services have to face. And that, you know, you can shoot a satellite, as you pointed out, from a land-based missile, a sea-based missile, and airborne. We did that in 1985 with an F-15. We had a satellite. So we've demonstrated this capability. And our adversaries, it sounds like, are fielding those lasers from the ground. But also you have to worry about co-orbital engagements where an adversary satellite comes up and does something nefarious to one of ours. And also cyber, because you're so dependent, your command and control of the space domain is so dependent on the cyber infrastructure. So any thoughts on that you want to share about how you're thinking about the defensive side?
Yep. I would tell you that, going back to kind of where I started with having domain awareness, having improved surveillance and reconnaissance of space, I'm seeing significant PLA maneuver and movement in geo, right? From a set of satellites. One of them.
And that geosynchronous orbit.
Geosynchronous orbit, which is further out and generally stays over its point on Earth as the Earth rotates.
So our DirecTVs.
But that's critical terrain in outer space. It's critical terrain in outer space for a number of reasons that isn't readily understood by people outside of space ops. You want to stay over a certain part of the Earth if you're doing, say, like missile warning, if you're providing communications, if you're doing an alerting function with exquisite electro-optical or radar imagery, like the PLA are doing now. They recently put a radar imager in GEO. In August.
Must be a big satellite.
It is. And it's designed to look at the Western Pacific, even though they say it's about agriculture. The Western Pacific that it's looking at is over the ocean. So, you know, we kind of know what the purpose is. But the point here is we're watching maneuver, we're detecting maneuver, and then we're characterizing maneuver so we can develop pattern of life on key assets that are in orbit. We watched very closely with the success of ExoAnalytics, which is a commercial company wrapped into that larger infrastructure I talked about at the beginning, of the SJ-21, which was a satellite that removed a defunct TNT satellite for the Chinese. So we watched that. They've built models. They've put it on their website. It's pretty clear that that satellite that can go and grab a defunct satellite could be used for multiple different purposes, right? Another thing that we're seeing in orbit, and you kind of talked about cyberspace, is the cyberspace layer of what's in orbit. It's widely known about the Biosat attack that Russians executed the 48 hours prior to the second invasion of Ukraine. So what I need the American public to intimately understand is that space is a warfighting domain, not because we want it to be, but because our adversaries have made it so.
Right.
And they have made it so not just with words and not just with deeds. They've done it with continuous funding and the development of armaments that they have put in the field.
That are fielded. This is not just concepts.
Yes, sir.
And I think we've shown incredible restraint, and now we're past that tipping point. I'm glad you talked about radar satellites, because that was going to be my next question. The Joint STARS was a great capability, a radar platform, air-breathing radar platform that can observe ground-moving targets in a theater of operation, has been retired, and the mission is moving to the space domain. Are you confident that we'll be able to deliver timely information to the warfighter in this new deployment? And in And then there's the Title 10, Title 50 debate. Who's going to be in charge of this, of this constellation? In the past, it was the Title 10. Mm-hmm. There was no discussion about the national intelligence community managing Joint Stars. That was a theater asset. Uh-huh. Any thoughts on this going forward?
Yeah, I spend a lot of my staff time working this issue, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And if I could, I'm going to zoom back to like two steps prior to that discussion. So why would the Secretary of the Air Force need to move moving target indicator and battle management systems to the space layer? He would need to do that because our adversaries have built, fielded, and now employ exquisite air defense assets that push our airborne assets back. And when you push an airborne asset back, and someone who flies a U-2 knows that at about, you know, 62,000 feet, your line of sight's about 300 nautical miles, right? But then you get curvature of the earth problem. Mm-hmm. And you're not able to observe, you're not able to sense, and it degrades. So if those defensive air defense weapons push you back far enough, that airborne platform is no longer relevant. So the need to sense inside the adversary's weapon engagement zone remains. It remains for the Department of Defense because we need to prepare to win a fight, right? Mm-hmm. So moving target indicator is an important part of a battle management system that allows us to track targets, feed that track with intelligence to gain positive identification, we call it PID, and then maintain track so that we can launch weapons against the target, update the weapon if the target is moving. This space layer is critical to maintaining that mission essential function, mm-hmm. and not regressing.
And it'll be able to do it globally as opposed to just regionally within line of sight of the airplane, as you said.
Yeah, right. And then there's some tremendous benefits to this whole approach. Some of the, there's two that I'm going to highlight that are not readily understood by folks. When we move this constellation to space and we get to a full operational capabilities, space vehicle number, we'll be providing this service, say, in the Taiwanese Strait. At the same time, we're providing that service over in EUCOM. Mm-hmm. At the same time, for the first time ever, that maybe AFRICOM's getting some ISR support, or excuse me, some surveillance support for reconnaissance. Right. So it allows us to support multiple combat commanders simultaneously. When we talk about the DoD tactical intelligence requirement, it's clear that the DoD has always had tactical intelligence requirement. What we've done is we've serviced it with tactical platforms. The change in thinking here is this moving to space, it's a tactical platform in space. And our use of space as a community, right, has always considered it special and strategic, and it's drawn us into policy discussions about things. But space is no longer only strategic. Space is tactical. Mm-hmm. And our adversaries have made it so. I'm not concerned that from a technical readiness level, we're going to have an issue. This is doing tracks from radars, Department of Defense, and our industrial base. We know how to do that.
Right.
What we need to do is make sure that we can rapidly process and move those tracks into warfighting formations. The Space Force proposal, since we're part of the joint force and we've stood up components in each of the combatant commands, is to make sure that our component can service their component partners, whether it's the Army component, the Maritime component, or the Air Force component, with timely, relevant MTI capability based off the direction of their joint combatant commander.
Sounds like a Title 10 mission. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I will say the second big benefit of this is it can be completely integrated with the national intel community.
Well, you would share the data with everyone.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so why everyone would, benefits.
Why wouldn't you? And if you think about when I was a captain and, you know, JSTARS is in the Middle East with me, the data collected from that platform, it wasn't shared back with the whole community. It was stuck in a silo of excellence, and it was exploited and used for that purpose, and then it went away. We have moved so far forward by making sure that we're interoperable, integrated, right? Not just interoperable, but integrated with all that America can bring to bear. This will be a significant leap forward in a positive way for both communities.
How about defending the asset? Because, you know, the JSTARS could always turn around and run away, or you bring up 15s or F-22s up to defend against any air threat against them. You can't run away in space.
You can't. There are a couple things you can think about, though, right? Like, this will be an asset that's in LEO, right? You can think
in the lowest Earth orbit.
Yeah, in the lowest Earth. Thank you. So in the lowest Earth orbit, you think about the numbers of these that you will buy, right? And you think about proliferating this architecture so that it can be difficult to destroy multiple of them, because each one of those missiles that the Chinese would launch, right, super expensive. So the fact that you proliferate your architecture and don't just have like six satellites that can do this, mm-hmm. but you, I won't give you the real number, but you can have lots of satellites that do this, it makes it difficult for them to disrupt. It's sort of the model you're seeing in proliferated LEO architectures today. Mm-hmm. They're difficult to take down because, one, there's so many of them.
Right.
But two, think about this. If you're lying in I'm talking to an astronaut. So now that I'm talking about, you know, things in outer space, it's like trying to brief your professor at grad school. It's a little tough. But like, if you're lying in the backyard, right, and you're looking up and something's going over at LEO, it's going over really fast. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to know what it is, track it, send that firing solution to a firing element, and get that engagement as it's zipping over you, because you only have a field of view that's, you know, right, kind of short. Things in geo, they sit there, so it makes it easier, right, for you. But so the lower proliferated LEO architecture is going to meet the need.
Right. And the key is proliferation.
Yes, sir.
Just
yes,
in numbers.
Yes, sir. And the other thing is, this is one capability in a whole basket of capabilities that are being proliferated down in a very rapid manner that have absolutely changed the calculus if I was the PLA version of me.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier the partnerships with friendly nations, mm-hmm. and commercial industry that you developed both for space situational awareness, but I would assume it's also for capabilities to collect surveillance and reconnaissance from space. I mean, we have commercial companies that take pictures from space today that, mm-hmm. a taboo is we never talked about back in the 80s and the 90s is gone because it's been commercialized.
Yeah.
As you think about one of the important things I would think in the intelligence community is if you're controlling that U2, as you described, you want to be able to task where the sensor looks. And mm-hmm. you do that in the air domain. Is the warfighter going to have the appropriate tasking authority for these commercial assets or even Space Force assets that might be fielded to do surveillance like GMTI or reconnaissance from space? Will that tasking authority and prioritization of targeting and use of that resource lie on the Title 10 side?
It will. It'll be directed by, let's just say it's something we're using, one of the new capabilities that we'd be using to help inform terrestrial warfighting as it execute. We would want the geographic combatant commander through their Space Force component commander, right?
Right.
To kind of put in their request for targeting. If it's something to deliver space superiority, right? The U.S. SPACECOM commander, right? Would be the one that would be directing the collection and tasking of that.
Great.
About the IC part of this. So we all know that the Department of Defense spends about $880 billion a year, right? The last public data, which is usually a year behind, from the DNI herself on her webpage, is that about $80 billion is the national intel budget. What I try to tell people is my job as sort of the pivot between the DOD and also as a head of the intel community element for mm-hmm. Space Force is, how do I leverage that $80 billion to help work towards the needs of Secretary Kendall and General Saltzman, right? How do I help empower the guardians that are in the field with not just things that were bought with the $880 billion, but also the $80 billion? And then I would give you one other calculus, which is what I've been working on as a general officer now for 4 years. It's building my partnerships with my coalition partners. What can a taxpayer in Munich help the German government pay for that helps with space domain awareness?
That was going to be my next question. How are those partnerships working out?
They're good. I'm on a first name basis with about 6 to 10 different partners around the world. We have a relationship of trust, right? So they don't always want me to talk about it. That relationship of trust is about being there with the data, but also about having two-way exchange, right? Because it's not appropriate for the taxpayer in Detroit to be paying for the free world. The free world should be paying for the free world.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, our defense industrial base is quite advanced compared to others. But sometimes it's not a one for one trade in kind. You know, if I give them an orange, I don't need an orange back. All countries have human services, right? All of them have access. All of them have analysis because they live in a different part of the world with a different perspective. All of those types of products are very valuable as you try to think about what someone else is thinking about.
Right. I think we all share a common interest, though, in keeping space a domain that warfare does not break out in.
Yes.
And so we all agree on those oranges, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, there's a common interest that's way more closer to home. And it's about, you know, recognizing international borders and deterring aggression of hostile states and the buy-in about the rule of law, not just domestically, but internationally for solving disputes. It's very clear that there's two camps in the world and how they look at that. And our allies and partners are feeling that pressure. You feel that pressure if you have a claim in the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's responsible to take your Coast Guard and your maritime militia and water hose and water cannon other countries? That's not how you handle it. You take it to the international court. The international court makes a decision. CCP didn't like the decision.
Right, so they don't abide by it.
Yes, sir.
So that's great. Now, before we go to questions from our audience, let me close with just asking you about what the intelligence groups in the Space Force are doing to support training. And your relationship with STARCOM is really what
I'm
pulling. So that's the training command in the Space Force. How are you guys working together with regard to maybe modeling and sim development, providing realistic training scenarios, et cetera?
Okay. That's a great question. That's a second level intel question, right? Because the first level intel question that I think we always could answer is, what is that? Oh, that's a PLA satellite. It does this. The second level question is, how does that satellite behave? What's its orbital parameters? When does it move around? All of those type of things are being now developed and captured by Guardian Intelligence. In fact, in 2 years, we've gone from tens of models to we have almost 1,100 models done on threat satellites. Now, that's not 1,100 different satellites, okay? Because we have to do a physical model. What does this look like? How does it measure? What's the size? We have to do a behavioral model. What does this satellite do over time? We also have to do an engineering model. What's behind that? I can't see that. So how do I assess what that could be?
Mm-hmm.
All of that is taking place inside our National Space Intelligence Center, which is NSIC, which was established at Wright-Patt. Additionally, for the tactics analysis, tactics are useful, right? But they're just stuff that are on the shelf until I engage my operator and say, this is how Red is going to behave against you. What are you going to do? And then you're a test pilot. Well, I'm going to develop counter tactics. That is taking place inside the Space Force today as well. And we have a squadron. We stood up three new squadrons to help complete the missing pieces for space operational intelligence. We talked about one was targeting. We talked about one, which was real-time exploitation of sensors on operationally relevant timelines. The third one was tactics and analysis. And that's the squadron, which is known as the 74th. So the 74th, the 75th, and the 76th are all new labor that has been grown. Additional new labor, over 400 people, have been grown inside U.S. Space Command from 0 to 400 to help do the J-2 that you remember way back in the day, because that went away. That all came back. All of this human capital investment is delivering finished intelligence now to command and control decision makers and squadron commanders and operators of satellites. We are moving fast. We are moving in the right direction. And between U.S. Space Command and U.S. Space Force and our IC partners, we're moving together.
Great. General Gagnon, this is refreshing to hear this all come together in a way that I think for those of us in our audience and myself who kind of grew up in a time period where we didn't do any of these things in space, but we did them all in the other domains, air, land, and sea, to see how fast space is stepping up here, the Space Force is stepping up, and U.S. Space Command to address the issues that our adversaries present to us today. So thank you for that. Yeah. And we have a little bit of time left. I'd like to turn our attention to questions from the audience. And for our audience, Aiden will be organizing the questions that we can hear them in here. I'd ask you to be sure to unmute your mic and also identify yourself, and if you're working with a particular organization, to identify that as well. So Aiden, over to you. Who do we have up first?
First, we have a written question from Frank Wolf from Defense Daily. He asks, Secretary Kendall has said in congressional testimony this past week that his greatest regret is that the fiscal 2025 budget request was not able to devote more funding to counter space campaigning because of budget constraints. Well, I said that a lot of those sort of capabilities are largely classified. What are the primary broad sets of needs in this area? And can you comment on some current systems like the counter communication systems, Meadowlands, or Bounty Hunter?
So I really applaud Secretary Kendall's engagement with Congress. He's had very frank discussions, both that you're recapping, but also inside the security vaults that they do follow-on questions for. I think about 25 or 24% of the Space Force budget is focused on responsible counter-space campaigning or space superiority, if you will. I obviously can't tell you all the pieces that are inside there. But what I will tell you is we're actively talking about this with our, you know, board of directors who pay for us, right, Congress, so that they understand the needs at a very precise level. The other thing, it was the beginning of your question, and I wanted to highlight this. I want everyone to understand this. The PLA funding from 24 to 25 went up 7.1%. 7.1%. So in the past, we often talked about defense budget as not a competitive issue, right? It wasn't vis-a-vis someone else, right? I'm telling you that they're going 7%. We aren't.
What are we growing?
Yeah, we aren't. We have to make trades in. I will tell you, Greg Gagnon, you know, I'm just a two-star in the Pentagon, and I have champagne dreams. But I live on a beer budget.
Very good. Next question.
Next, we have a question from Teresa Hitchens from Breaking Defense that she also submitted in written form. She asks, specifically with regard to GMT satellites being jointly developed by the Space Force and NRO, has there now been an agreement when it comes to tasking authority, or is that something that is still being worked out?
I think everyone is aware that the National Defense Authorization Act, you know, said that the SECAF would develop the capability and present that capability to joint warfighters for employment. And much of my time is spent figuring out how to optimize that tasking so that, one, we support the Joint Force Commander, right? Because that's our remit. I'm a military service. That's what I'm supposed to do. But also, in doing so, how do we build profound secondary and tertiary benefit for a lot of people?
Right. We talked about this earlier.
Yeah. Make it a win-win, right? And we're working on that. I have spent the last 3 days actually out at NGA with Admiral Wentworth. Yesterday was with Admiral Wentworth and Dr. Scalise. We're in meetings. We're talking about the best way to optimize taxpayer money that supports the joint warfighting need, because we must be able to do moving target indicator with sensor control from the warfighters so that they can close kill chains. That's our remit.
Okay, great.
Next, we have a question from Robert Williams on doing threat information sharing. How has partnering with commercial partners opened up what you can share with the broader public and with allies and partners compared to what was possible in the past with more classified programs and sensors?
Yeah, it's been significant. It has been significant. I have been on this project, this point of messaging about the threat, for 4 years in two different jobs. In my last job, I started like a space threat one sheet that I started writing, which was drawn from unclassified material and you know, kind of thought about what I needed to say. Now with the commercial partners I use for commercially acquired information, which is a type of information, CAI, I am able to observe the domain, monitor the domain, identify maneuver in the domain, and talk about that. I can talk about the SJ-21. I can talk about all of the apertures that I'm using from a commercial perspective, if that contract allows that. A lot of this is contract specific. those contracts and our vendors, you know, sometimes have releasability restrictions because they're trying to segment markets to make profits. What I promise to do is follow the rules of the contract. But I'm bringing that to bear so that America understands that space and space capabilities are under threat.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the frustrations I'd heard from some small space companies mm-hmm. that were fielding ISR, intelligence surveillance, reconnaissance assets in space, is that the only contracts they could get were with the NGA. And in that sense, they felt they were frustrated because it's a different mission set that they have. It's national intelligence. It's incredibly yeah. important to our national security. But there's a prioritization process of what images are taken, for example. Yep. And then there's a long analysis process, and then it comes out. But the warfighter needs things quickly.
Yep.
And they're, I'm sure they're okay with that process in peacetime, mm-hmm. but exercising the capability quickly almost seems to suggest that the Space Force should be developing their own capabilities and at the same time contracting directly with some of these companies so that they can get it, mm-hmm. the data more quickly. Some of the companies have said, you know, we could get it to you faster if you would just task yeah. it and you do your own analysis, your own exploitation of the resource.
So they've made the same pitch to us and we've taken the bite. So let me explain two things. When I talked about, you know, over 600 apertures around the world, what I was talking about was me purchasing commercially available information to help me understand what's going on in the space domain.
So it's looking up.
That's looking up.
Yeah.
Or sometimes in space, looking at space, across. Right? I could do yeah. both. North Star has a concept for that. That's yeah. fantastic. But let me flip the script. Now I'm in space, looking from space of the Earth. The U.S. government spends about $400 million a year in the commercial remote sensing industry through NRO and NGA in order to satisfy the needs of the national intelligence community and the joint combatant commanders. That's kind of a deliberate process.
Mm-hmm.
The Space Force executed a pilot last year, which was known as Tactical Surveillance, Reconnaissance, and Tracking, TAC-SRT. TAC-SRT has some seed money that has allowed us to build ad hoc rapid contracts that are serviced in a marketplace that SSC runs. And what it allows you to do is if you have a time urgent, mm-hmm. right, time dominant requirement, and you need to satisfy it with something you can share with country X, right? You can go to this marketplace, type in your need, and we have taught each of the combatant commanders this, type in their need. And then the contractors that are certified inside this construct, I think there's 35 that are certified now, have 72 hours to get back their proposal. Once that proposal goes back to Colonel Rich Nisley, okay, that's your name if you're writing it down and you're a contractor, at SSC, he goes through the marketplace and decides whether there are funds to apply to that. The Space Force has seeded this idea with funds to get it going. And it's about rapidly employing commercial remote sensing to a problem, but we only do it after checking with NGA and NRO to make sure they don't already have a contract commercially that can solve that problem. Because the second thing we want to make sure is we properly use taxpayer money, right?
Yeah, you don't want a bidding war between DOD and USDI.
Or we don't want to have already paid for that service, right? So we're checking to be a good steward of US taxpayer dollars, but we don't want to lose the dynamicism of our commercial sector. We are focusing not on pixels. We are focusing on commercial services. We want those combatant commanders to talk to you about, hey, I need to know this kind of problem. And then these combatant commanders can use their own checkbook or their own impact card to buy this service. Because our vision on this isn't that we're running all the funding, because this is like free chicken. Everybody loves free chicken.
Thank you. Next question.
We have time for a final question from Michael Buck. Mike, go ahead and talk.
Yeah, hi, this is Michael Buck. I'm the Space Capabilities Guy for the Order of Dedalions. And I was wondering, would it be worth revisiting the National Aerospace Plane or NASP concept in order to capitalize on the rapid offensive response, flexibility, and defensive capabilities that could be provided by manned vehicles to attack on-orbit, airborne, and ground targets?
I'm not familiar with your program, so yeah.
This was a program, the National Aerospace Plane was, I believe it was in the late 80s, early 90s, a concept of a takeoff from the ground, accelerate to hypersonic speed, perhaps suborbital, and go anywhere in the world and to either take a picture, collect intelligence, or maybe hold an adversary capability in space or anyplace else at risk. And so it was going to have beyond Earth atmosphere capability, but it wasn't going way okay. high in space. And it was manned. It was planned to be manned. Okay. And, you know, using some hypersonic engine technology that had not been developed at the time. But now we're starting to see that technology being fielded with the hypersonic cruise missiles. So the engine problem seems to have advanced. I guess the question is, do you see, if I may, Mike, do you see a need for a human element no. to be involved, you know, on the vehicle as opposed to controlling it remotely like you control YouTube?
I went through the cultural extension of the Air Force as we moved from manned platforms to predominantly unmanned platforms. And at the risk of not making it out of the room, I'd say astronauts are incredibly important, sir, but astronauts are not the solution for things that we need
for this particular problem.
Yes, sir, because we got to put them in a threat envelope.
Yeah. So they're still necessary, though.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Well, with that, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of the Sugar Space Power series. And General Gagnon, I can't thank you enough for breaking out of the Pentagon to come over here and spend time with me and with our audience. And I hope the audience enjoyed this very much. It was a great conversation. So to our audience, thanks for dialing in and participating, and wish you all a great space, excuse me, great space power day.